Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. I'm Kelly Ash, senior researcher at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. We are a private, nonpartisan, nonprofit organization based in rural Minnesota, where we are dedicated to providing data-driven research on rural issues to help our policymakers make more informed decisions affecting the rural people and places of our state.
In this episode, we are talking about the current state and potential future of elder care, specifically nursing facilities, assisted living, and home health care.
Joining me to talk about this important issue are Carrie Thurlow, who is the president and CEO of Leading Age Minnesota, as well as Tracy Hendricks, who is the vice president of long-term care at Perham Health in Perham, Minnesota. Thanks for joining us, you two. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
I think a good place to start, why don't we start with you, Carrie? Can you just talk a little bit about what is Leading Age Minnesota, real briefly?
Yeah, thanks for having me, first and foremost. Leading Age Minnesota is a statewide organization here in Minnesota that represents about 1,300 senior care organizations statewide. So we are the largest organization of senior care providers in the state, representing the full continuum of senior care services. So everything from nursing homes and assisted living to home care and independent senior housing and adult day and other community-based services. We are a nonprofit organization that supports our members by providing technical assistance, advocacy, and education.
And Tracy, can you talk a little bit about your role at Perham Health?
Yeah, so I am a nursing home administrator and assisted living director by trade. In my current role, I oversee most of the services Carrie was just talking about. Perham Health is a critical access hospital system that's managed by Sanford. So we're locally owned, and we cover all of the services pretty much from birth to end of life. So in my job, I have the opportunity to oversee more of the longer term care services, so home care, assisted living, older adult housing, low income housing, skilled nursing, adult day services. And then a really cool program that we've been able to do in partnership with Leading Age, that's called Elevate.
Hey, great. I hope to hear more about that in our conversation. And I was actually just on Highway 10 not that long ago. Are you in the brand new nice building that you guys built out there?
Yeah, I am actually about a mile away from it is where my office is, but I oversee some of the acute care services as well. So I spend a fair amount of time there.
Yeah, that's nice. And it's so great to see Perham building out so much. A lot of homes going up. I'm really happy for Perham. They've been on our radar for quite a few years now in terms of being pretty forward thinking with some of the stuff they're doing there. So happy to have you on our show today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start out. I don't mean to start out negative, but I know there's a lot of challenges facing skilled nursing facilities, assisted living, and home health care. And Carrie, you're out and about, you're talking to a lot of these folks. What are some of the main themes in terms of the barriers and challenges that you're seeing these service providers face?
Yeah, thanks for the question. You know, I think it's important before we talk about the challenges for providers to frame those challenges, it's important to point out that I think we all know this, that Minnesota is at a pretty critical inflection point where we have a rapidly aging state. We are now, for the first time in our state's history, seniors, those over the age of 65, outnumber school-aged children. And that's particularly true in greater Minnesota, in rural parts of the state, where, you know, the demographics have really flipped. In many rural communities, we have the number of seniors outnumbering working age Minnesotans. We have increasing demand. The good news is that, you know, while we have aging population with a lot of wisdom and experience that can really inform the way we move forward, the vast majority of individuals that reach the age of 65 will need some form of senior care before end of life. And so we have that growing demand, but we don't necessarily have the workforce in a variety of settings to really meet that demand. And so as a result, we are seeing nursing homes in Minnesota, particularly in rural Minnesota, closing and shrinking at a time where we have growing demand, such that, you know, Minnesota has lost a third of its nursing home beds in the last 20 years. In rural Minnesota, it's 42% of nursing home beds have disappeared in the last two decades. And that, combined with financial fragility, has really made this question of accessing care and services that one needs in their home communities a real question for many Minnesotans.
Yeah, and it's interesting that we have this demand supposedly, absolutely increasing because we have an aging demographic, particularly, as you said, in rural Minnesota, where we're probably going to peak before the metropolitan areas in terms of that demographic. And at the same time, you have a market that's interesting. You have services that are for acute issues, recovery, things like that. And then you have other roles being played by, let's say, assisted living. Home-based care can kind of straddle both of those in terms of helping acute folks and folks that maybe don't need as much. They don't need to be in a nursing home, right? But all of that is kind of crashing into, as you're talking about, just not enough people to work these jobs. So even though we have services that are available, we don't necessarily have the workers to be in those service, providing those services. That's kind of the biggest issue you see facing. Is that correct?
I think that that's the critical, the most critical thing that we are facing. You know, it becomes a little bit of a cycle when you don't have the workers in our member settings, in provider communities. They can't accept residents. They can't accept more people to care for. We're just not going to do that. And therefore, there is a limitation on revenue and it becomes a financial struggle. So it becomes a cycle. And yet, we know from our own data, 88% of rural Minnesotans expect to access their long-term care within an hour's drive of their community. So that is the other piece, that we have this demand and expectation, and yet this cycle of fragility that really demands a pretty significant effort to address.
Yeah. And I know you also brought up to the financial side of things, which isn't keeping up either. We kind of have probably a financial framework based on history rather than modern reality. And so we'll talk about that in a little bit later in this conversation. But Tracy, I want to turn it to you. I know what Carrie's talking about, you know, these are some of the main themes she's hearing out in the field. Is that something you see, you know, as someone that's, you know, on the ground?
Yeah, we definitely do. So we see it throughout our services for sure. We've been really fortunate that we haven't had to decrease our bed capacity. We did during COVID, but we brought it back. But we are one of the few nursing homes and assisted livings that can admit to our full capacity, but we don't have availability. So our long-term beds stay pretty much 100% occupied. And so when we can't take somebody, they are going, they have to travel a long way. So, and that's pretty unique to us. Most places can't admit to their full capacity. So we're really fortunate that way. And then the other challenges is when people can't, in metro areas, it's a little bit different because there's more resources available. So the reasons why people are looking for care differ a little bit in rural communities, because it might be that they can't, it's the food insecurity piece. They might have means, but they can't drive anymore, and we don't have transportation services. We have a bus company in our community that can transport like within 5 miles of Perm. Well, we don't have a lot of people within 5 miles of Perm that necessarily need that, but there's a lot of people in that are on their farms or at their lake homes. Perm is, again, very unique that we have a lot of people that come to retire to this community. So they don't necessarily have those ingrained social networks that somebody who grew up here might have. So they don't necessarily know who to call. You know, they might not have the best relationship with their neighbors that you would have if it was somebody that you live next to your whole life. So it's really being able to kind of figure out how do we provide those services to people that, you know, when you can't call Uber Eats because you can't, you know, you don't, you, you can't deliver meals to your mom or order meals to or grocery delivery. We don't have those services, which just creates an extra piece, an extra challenge, because that need for the services that we do provide them is that much more, it's that much more needed, but maybe in a different way than it would be in larger communities.
Yeah, we always talk about it. The metropolitan areas have a, probably a more dense or robust nonprofit ecosystem that can provide services. Well, then the question is, well, why? Why do they have a more robust ecosystem? Well, it's all about economies of scale, right? So those services, those nonprofits can kind of keep going a little bit more sustainably because they don't have to drive 20, 30 miles, 40 miles to deliver goods to one farm place, right? Everything is just more concentrated. And we see that not only in elder care, but just like so many services across Minnesota in rural areas, that that's the hardest part. I think you even can kind of see it in ambulance services and things like that, right? It's all about these economies of scale. Maybe we'll get to this, Tracy, and you can tell me right now if this is a later on question, but you guys have been really successful at keeping your positions filled and being at capacity. Any reason why you guys are kind of a success story in that sense?
Yeah, so I think there's a few reasons. First, I think we've done a lot to support our staffing. Leading Age has been really great in helping us get resources like the on-track nursing course. So we have staff that come through that class all the time. So it's an online program for CNAs. We have somebody who's full-time dedicated to just training CNAs in our organization, and that's been very helpful. We also partner with our local schools. So we offer one of the high school classes is offered in our building as a CNA class. And that's been very helpful as well, especially for those casual staff. And then they come in as our, they come in on our scholarship program oftentimes, and they want to be nurses. So then they come back and work for us after they get done with college. So that's been huge as well. And then I think our culture, PERM has been very involved and very invested in our acute care side. It's patient and family centered care. On our nursing home assisted living side, it's person directed care and a household model. So it's, I'm really proud of our staff that they've made it really a great place to live. People want to come here, and nobody wants to move to a nursing home. That's not a dream that most of us have, but when they do, I think us being able to provide a place that people don't dread moving to is a big deal as well, especially in a community like ours where options are limited.
Yeah, that's, so you got a lot going on. Do you attribute that to being a part of a healthcare system? Do you find that to be pretty advantageous for your ability to implement a lot of different ideas and programs?
Yes. Yeah, it definitely is beneficial. One, the resources is huge. And then like our medical director is one of our providers at our clinic who and within our system. So he's able to come over and have our nursing home as a clinic site. So our residents don't have to leave the building when it's 25 below to go over to the clinic to be seen. And then it also helps with rehospitalizations and things like that too, that if we see somebody who maybe it looks like they might have something brewing, they can be seen on a Friday by him rather than having to go to the ED on a Saturday. So all of those things, they really help with our quality. They help with our residents' quality of life and our staff satisfaction, which makes a big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. So Carrie, Leading Age keeps coming up as like a great partner and some of this programming and stuff like that. What are some other kind of innovative ideas that people are implementing to take on some of these challenges?
Well, I think Tracy and Purim in general serves as a really great example. I think she's touched on a number of strategies that we're seeing, whether it is using online training, which is, you know, quite frankly, something that you wouldn't have seen even 15 years ago, online training of CNAs, you know, partnering with high schools to build that workforce pipeline. We are seeing rural communities building and developing pipelines also to recruit international workers, knowing that we have, this numbers problem in many communities, bringing in more workers. We are seeing that as well. Zooming out, a number of rural providers in Minnesota are still standalone, independent nonprofits. And you spoke a little bit of this scale question. So we are seeing increasingly conversations about collaboration and partnerships. We know that rural communities, they cherish the community identity that they have with their sometimes governmentally owned or sometimes independent nonprofit nursing homes. So trying to find ways that they can partner with others, other organizations that have similar core values, where 1 + 1 can equal 3, but where they can still retain their community identity. We're seeing that more and more. So whether it is partnering on those areas where they can get economies of scale, whether it is accounting or even, sort of sharing staffing models or administration, we're seeing some unique collaborations that way. Tracy touched on also building this idea of community partnerships within communities. So she touched on connected communities, and I know we'll talk about it in a moment. But the whole spirit of that program is building so that it is not just a provider operating in isolation, but creating a network of supports with other community partners so that individuals can access the care and services they need, whether it is healthcare services or social services, through a network. So we're being as efficient and as smart as possible. So we're seeing those. The last thing I would touch on is we are seeing rural providers deploying technology in new and innovative ways. Our business, if I can call it a business, it requires a lot of hands-on care. We are never going to replace people, but we can use technology to be more efficient. And so we are seeing the deployment of robots in some of our settings, especially to assist in like dining and housekeeping and some of those areas, so that we can free up caregivers to do what they do best, which is the hands-on care. And some of those strategies have made a huge difference as well.
Carrie, I think something came across our email maybe last month at some point of a program or grant opportunity, if I remember correctly, that you guys are offering. Which piece was that again?
So right now we are, through our foundation, there are two major grants that we are working on right now. PERM is part of one of those grant programs and is actually one of the original programs called Connected Communities. Right now, I think we are up to 6 pilot sites and 6 rural communities, and that is focused exclusively on rural communities to build out these community networks. The other grant program that we are working on and are just in the early stages is a partnership with the state of Minnesota, related to the recruitment and retention of new Americans into our settings. Many of our members are utilizing trying to explore strategies to bring new Americans into their settings. There are people all over the world that want to come and work for us, highly trained nurses and other caregivers. And so that's a process in and of itself. But we want to make sure that providers are very equipped to also make sure that we have welcoming, inclusive environments that want to make them want to stay once they come. So that grant through the state of Minnesota is really aimed at helping that process, whether it is translating training materials into other languages, whether it is to create groups where providers can brainstorm with each other on strategies or other tools and resources to help support providers in their recruitment efforts.
That's great. So a lot really focused on workforce.
Yeah.
Challenge, sure. Yeah. Tracy, do you guys have anything kind of you're planning on or lining up for future initiatives or programs that you're excited about or you think might help?
Yeah. So this might be a good time to talk about what we're doing with our Connected Communities work. So we are We were really fortunate to receive the first round of the Connected Communities grant, which came at a great time. I think it was 2020. So when nursing homes and healthcare had all sorts of extra time on our hands to, you know, that's sarcasm there, but we were able to kind of do a lot of planning during the COVID years. And one thing that was really beneficial for us as we did that, actually looking back on it now, is we didn't realize until COVID how much social isolation plays a part in people's overall well-being, and how, especially in rural communities, it is so easy for people to be socially isolated. And with that, the other risk factors that come in is just people aren't checking on them. They don't know if they're eating well. They don't know if they're having mental health issues. They don't know if they're taking their medications correctly. So looking back on it, I think that the timing of this was actually, as challenging as it was really good, because we saw issues come to light that we never would have seen otherwise, had it been any other time. So we started from that grant, we've developed our program, it's Elevate. And there's so many facets to it that it's really hard to explain it in a nutshell, but it's really, it's engaging people in our community, and we're not targeting necessarily the old population. It's not the people who are really needing to enter long-term care right now. We're trying to engage people much younger, because we know that chronic conditions and the reasons why people admit to our settings, that takes a lot of years prior to actually needing the care in order to make some lifestyle changes. So we have a program that's really meeting people where it's at. It's two-sided. We have a community side, and then we have a health coach in our clinic setting. So wherever we meet people and whatever we see their needs are, our goal is to be able to kind of help them through that and give them the resources that they need in order to build a support system around them, build healthier lifestyles, in order to continue to be well longer. So there's everything from events that help to create those connections in the community. So sometimes it's just about the mixer, and it'll be education, and it's actually at a brewery or at something like that. But there are people connecting, and it is a lot of those people who live on the lakes or are newer to the community. They're able to plug in and actually kind of grow that social network. We also have had the opportunity to restart our senior center in our community, and make it, it's now housed in our community center, which is a beautiful building. It's like a YMCA in the metro, but then it has some meeting room spaces and kids play areas, all of it. So people are able to come there, and now we're seeing those groups of people who used to maybe, it was a very small group of people that met at our senior center. Now we're outgrowing the space that we have at the community center, and they're having a lunch, and that social piece, but they're also like working out beforehand or after, or they'll go for a walk. So we're integrating that physical fitness piece as well. And people are actually reporting, like, I never thought this would actually improve my health, but it is. And they're telling us that, even the people who are a little more hesitant about the idea to begin with. We also have volunteerism. So we've created kind of a volunteer hub in our community. So everything from our Rotary groups to our high school kids to just people who maybe want to restock books at the library every once in a while. We know that purpose, having something to look forward to when you wake up every morning, is really, really important. So there's volunteer opportunities. And then on the flip side of that, from the Firm Living campus, it works really well because people can sign up to come in and help with happy hour or do spend some one-on-one time with our residents or be greeters at the hospital. So it's helping from a workforce standpoint as well for us. And then there's a part-time work opportunity with that too. So we have pulled in some of those people who went, they retired, but maybe they weren't quite ready to be fully done. So we have people working in our community in part-time capacities that are kind of those fun jobs that post-retirement that they're able to really enjoy and provide back to those businesses too. I mentioned transportation earlier. That's another one that is really hard because it's not, you might have to drive 30 miles to pick somebody up in a bus to bring them to an appointment. So it's, when we talk about the scalability piece of it, you can't really make money doing that. So we bought a van. And we have volunteers now that will drive out and pick people up for those appointments. It doesn't fit for every situation, but at least it can provide a stopgap usually until we can figure out what else will work for these people. There's meal programs, so that's another one. Meals on Wheels only provides services within a pretty small area. So our dietary and nutrition services within our organization now makes and freezes meals. And then we have a volunteer that can drive those meals out to people that are outside of the Meals on Wheel radius once a week or once every 2 weeks so that they have nutrition and healthy meals at home. There's so much. And then the RN health coach piece of it, she's doing a really great job with most of us. I joke when I say this, but it's a very true thing. Most of us aren't entirely honest with our doctors. Like you get maybe 10 or 15 minutes with them. When they ask you some of those questions, like we all exercise a little bit more. We maybe don't participate in some of the less healthy activities that they ask us about as frequently as they ask us about it. So she really is able to, in a very non-judgmental way, build a relationship with people to figure out what are your risk areas and how can we help you with that and give you maybe some healthier alternatives or other ways that you can work through it. So she's gotten to some really, really cool, unique, some very challenging and some very messy situations with people. But the outcomes from those have been really, really incredible. And we have so many stories. I could tell you so many stories, but that would take a lot of time. So it's just really, really good work that's coming out of it. And a lot of it just comes down to getting to know people on an individual basis to figure out what exactly do they need in order to be able to live well, age well, be successful in their own home and their community, in order to be able to stay living at home longer.
This program is touching on so many different issues, right? Just from, you know, my own anecdotal experience, I grew up in Hancock, Minnesota. So if you know where that is, by Morris. And I remember when I was a kid, they actually tore down the senior center. Wasn't maybe being utilized as much or anything. And now they don't have one. But it's funny, you know, the people that are a bit older there in Hancock kind of ad hoc their own kind of senior center. And it's the gas station / coffee shop / used car sale place, right? And they all gather in the mornings or wherever. They kind of have these ad hoc groups now that form together. But I can imagine someone that isn't well connected to the community, is new, or lives a ways out, they don't have that ability to make those connections. So I think having, you know, somebody that's actually going to, that's their role, is to start making some of these connections, is just so insanely important. And I would argue too, you know, my mother still lives in Hancock, and you know, she's getting a little bit older. She still lives in the big single family home. And, you know, she's always looking for another home, but it's so hard in Hancock. There's just no one's building those type of patio style one level homes. And there may come a time where she may have to go to Morris or Alexandria or something like that. But, you know, one of the big things keeping her from doing that is her family's all in Hancock, right? And so if she did have to remove herself from the community to have, again, somebody making those connections, getting her introduced to other people, I mean, that's going to be so important, particularly when, you know, I think over the next 20 years, we're going to see a bit more, I don't know, consolidation, I know, can be kind of a dirty word, but you know, we're going to see these economies of scale work out or shake out in a way that people are going to have to move to some bigger cities, or using air quotes here, Morris's Hancock's big city, right? And so, man, having those connecting points, that's just so important. And I tell you what, I could use a health coach, but
I think we all could.
Well, I know this has been a great conversation, but I do want to turn it to kind of policy, regulations, financial support. So obviously this is a field in which government plays a pretty large role, both in terms of regulatory as well as financially, right? And there's always these stories in the paper about, you know, financially it's getting harder and harder. Regulations are increasing. Not that any the regulations are bad per se, but a lot of it can come down as, you know, unfunded mandates in a sense, right? And so maybe I'll start with Carrie, kind of talking about, you know, what's been the legislature's, and let's talk state policy here, because I know federal policy is a big deal, right? Medicare and Medicaid and all those. But from a state policy perspective, what's kind of been the historical role they've played, and kind of where are they heading, or where do you hope they head, maybe is a better way to put it.
Well, now you're going to get me fired up, aren't you? You know, I'm fond of saying, I've been here at Leading Age Minnesota for 18 years, and I often am fond of saying that aging issues and what our strategy is for meeting our obligation to provide the needed care and services for seniors is the number one issue that lawmakers don't talk about, or they love to avoid at the state level. Yet state lawmakers play a huge role in our ability to make to meet the needs of seniors, in particular here in Minnesota. So just a couple of fun facts here. In nursing homes, the biggest payer in Minnesota, nursing homes, the vast majority of nursing homes, is Medicaid. It is Medicaid, just to remind folks, are for low-income individuals that meet a certain income standard, but that also meet a level of care that says that they need nursing home level of care. And it is a right. If you meet the criteria for anyone, it is a right to be able to access nursing home care. But state lawmakers set the reimbursement rates for Medicaid. And in Minnesota, we have a quirky state law called rate equalization that also says that that's the private pay rate, which means that they essentially fix the prices for nursing homes in the state of Minnesota. And, you know, to be very honest, state funding hasn't kept up with what has been extraordinary inflation over the last several years. We've all felt it in our pocketbooks. It's no surprise that we're also seeing it in the delivery of senior care services. There is also a program called Elderly Waiver, which is Medicaid for senior care services outside a nursing home. Minnesota's done a really good job of making those services available, but again, hasn't kept up with funding. Right now, they peg their funding to 2017 costs. So pre-pandemic, pre-crazy inflation, which makes it really hard, especially when we've already talked about the challenges of economies of scale in rural Minnesota. It makes it exceptionally hard to financially make it work. But what is probably the worst part of it is that our, you know, I'll pin it on just our election cycle. A 2-year election cycle or a 4-year election cycle doesn't incentivize lawmakers to think about the future like we do in terms of what's the plan for how do we meet the needs of seniors, and how are we going to take care of this, you know, seniors with increasing demand and a shrinking workforce and challenging budget issues. There are very few lawmakers that think in those terms. And so it has been historically challenging.
I would imagine, too, there's been a lot of turnover at the legislature. So a lot of new legislators. I think at one point, if you included the folks that got elected during the pandemic, we kind of called them red shirt freshmen because they didn't even meet in person those first year or two. Right. So like, I think it was like 2022 or 2024, it was like 67% of the legislators were essentially new. I can imagine that can be quite a workload in trying to get all those legislators up to speed, because it's I don't think a lot of folks really realize how much government plays a role in some of this stuff. Do you find that to be true, or?
Yeah, it's daunting. I mean, the turnover at the legislature has been daunting. The education piece, et cetera. And I will also say, I mean, just the makeup of the legislature, this isn't a partisan issue. This isn't meant to pit regions against itself, but it is fundamentally true that the majority of the legislature comes from metro areas of the state that are somewhat more disconnected to senior care issues than their rural counterparts. So I've been, I have the benefit of living in the metro area, but have spent my entire career advocating on behalf of rural communities in many cases. And I've had metro lawmakers or metro regulators, because all of our state agencies are headquartered here, talk about, Tracy raised the question of food insecurity in rural communities. And they said, and I've had someone with a straight face say to me, well, they could just, DoorDash it. So there is a fundamental disconnect and understanding that is not meant to sort of denigrate anyone, but to understand that lived experience is very important and education is really important here.
Yeah, thanks for saying that. It's something, at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, we talk about all the time too, is understanding each other is the most important thing, and kind of we're lacking it, I think, lately, just due to the discourse that we have right now, where it's kind of angry and kind of feisty, and it's just too bad, particularly when we're all connected to our elders. We all have parents, we all have grandparents, and
we're all going to get old.
Yeah, totally.
I mean, if we're lucky, we are. I haven't met a single person in this state that is pulling a Benjamin Button. So, I mean, yeah. We are all aging.
Right, right. Well, Tracy, I want to throw it to you, and I know maybe you're not involved in the politics side of things, but I would be curious, as a health system, I think a lot of folks would be like, all right, if it's really hard to make this financially sustainable, why would Perm Health and Sanford even get involved in this stuff, right? But there must be a reason why this all works out. What is that? And if that's above your pay grade, I totally understand. But
no, so it is actually a topic of conversation that we have pretty regularly. As an organization, we believe in the strength of the continuum, and we're pretty invested in that. We're a hospital district, and we believe that it's an important service to continue providing for our community. We know that the options outside of PERM, people are going to have to travel. If we're not here to do it, who is going to do it? And then there's also the piece that we do believe that it has to turn at some point. We have to start getting reimbursed for some of the wellness care rather than the sick care. We have to start, and as soon as that happens, then home care has to be more well reimbursed. You look at the services that we're providing. So I think it's an important thing to do, but that I think for any organization that only goes so far, because if we have, about 50% of our organization that has a very hard time paying for itself, then how much longer, it puts that much more pressure on our acute care system, which those margins continue to shrink in acute care as well. So a lot of organizations have already rolled off their long-term care services. So I think long-term, we have to figure it out in order to make it sustainable, because as much as we are here to serve a community, we can't do that if the organization as a whole can't afford to do it, because you're just going to lose all of your services then. So I think that, I think that's your question in a nutshell. That's like right now, yeah, we're very, very committed to this. And we have been, Perm Health is not a new organization. Long-term care is not new to our organization. But we do need to make changes across the state in order to figure out how to do this for the next 100 years as well.
Yeah, I think, not only as a state, but as a country, right? There's a long ongoing conversation about how do we decrease healthcare costs? And we know that like the hardest or the heaviest expenses and costs come from very acute care, right? So If we try to cut there, it means we also have to invest in it on the front end so we don't have as much acute care, right? Right. So that's kind of like the big dilemma right now is we're just cutting. It seems like we're trying to, from a policy perspective, put a cap on how much we're reimbursing without investing and making sure those costs there go down as well, right? And that's, oh man, I know it's as a legislator, that's kind of hard to like, yeah, I can do that, but it doesn't have that immediate gratification, right? And then,
a perfect example of that is home care. You know, home care medical assistance pays very, very poorly. We lose money every time we send a staff person out to care for somebody on medical assistance. Now you add in the rural piece of it where they're driving 20 to 30 miles to see somebody who we're already losing money on. But if we don't see those people who a lot of them have comorbidities, they have mental health issues. You know, there's a bigger picture here. If we don't see them in their homes in one of the cheapest ways to provide care, they're going to be in our nursing home. So how, you know, I guess just to take a step back, and I wish so badly at the state and federal level, we could look at that. Like, how do we make the system actually flow? And instead of looking at separate pots of dollars, look at it from a more individualized standpoint. But
I think historically, that's why we have the elder care or the elderly waiver, right? Was to try and reduce usage of nursing homes because they're expensive and they're rising costly. Developed the elderly waiver to help pay for home care because it was cheaper and maybe even more effective in some instances, right? But I think without that historical knowledge, everybody just looks at this like, oh, we're just paying elder care everywhere without the sense of like, no, if we invest more here, it reduces our costs here. It's a good investment, right? That's a tough thing to get across, particularly I imagine when legislators are just being inundated with so many other issues and topics and policies. So before we go, I know we have the most recent Governor Walz just released his new budget. I don't know, Carrie, if you had time to look at that yet. Is there anything promising or disheartening, or, you know, what's it looking like this session?
Well, I will say that not to mince words, I think it's fair to say that we're fairly disappointed with Governor Walz's proposed budget out of the gates that he released last week, wherein, you know, full package all in, our estimate is that he would cut funding for senior care services at over $200 million compared to what our current funding is. And in the context of all the challenges that we've been talking about, whether it is to recruit more caregivers to our field, to expand access to a growing field, you know, I am very frequently without words, but I struggle sometimes to describe how wrong of a direction this is for Minnesota, and in particular, Greater Minnesota. You know, at a time where it's acknowledged that we have growing demand, we need to be looking at how do we increase and shore up the investment to stabilize organizations here. And we haven't even talked about all the unfunded mandates being passed on to these organizations. We're just talking about the cuts. So I think it's fair to say that we were deeply disappointed in the governor's budget proposal. The upside is that we know that it is the start of a conversation of what is sure to be a very long legislative session. We know that there is a bipartisan group of legislators that have already commented at their disappointment in this direction. And so we look forward to that ongoing conversation as we move forward. And, you know, to some extent, hope that we can get serious about what the future of Minnesota really needs, recognizing again the commitment that the state needs to make to this population and to not balance the budget on the backs of seniors and caregivers.
Yeah, thanks, Carrie. And thanks for keeping an eye on that stuff, advocating for rural Minnesota elders, the elderly, and the service providers. I think it's just so important. And to both of you, thank you so much for your work. And thank you for your time today for talking to me about this stuff. I really appreciate it. And Tracy, I know I'm going to head up to Perm. I'm even thinking of sending somebody up there to write a report on what you guys are up to. That all sounds really, really great. And just know at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, we're going to keep digging into these issues as well. I think we're going to have some reports looking further into workforce issues that you're facing, as well as the extent of how deep or not deep do services go into some of our rural areas. So we'll keep an eye on things too. We hope we can be helpful for you all. We know how important this is. So
yeah. Thank you for that work. We appreciate all that you're doing and look forward to partnering more.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.